We're in business. We're recording.
Oh, okay.
Here, I'll hand you your key. Okay. We're talking to Jim Patton, and Jim's an attorney who worked in the Babcock administration and worked for the Public Service Commission back in the 1950s. And so, Jim, you went to work in the 1950s when the Anaconda Company still owned the newspapers in the state and was still an important player in state politics. And so was the Montana Power Company.
Yes, sir.
And, of course, in your work with the Public Service Commission, you probably had frequent contact with Montana Power Company people.
I did.
And did you ever know personally Bob Corrett?
Oh, yes. Yes. Bob became a very good friend of mine. In later years, was a good friend. I was appointed as an assistant United States attorney in 1969, and when I went to Butte, I lived with Bob for 2 weeks before I found a place to live. But no, Bob was I admired Bob Corrett very much.
Now, part of the folklore of Montana, you know, is that the Montana Power Company and the Anaconda Company were the terrible twins, the controlling corporate influences in the state. And you would have had some perspective on that. Could you maybe share your thoughts with that?
Yeah. See, she came in to see you. Right? Here, come on now. Come on, Chloe. When I went to the law school, I was amazed at what they blamed on the Anaconda Company. If I swear to gosh, if we had a cold snap in it, snowed a lot, they'd blame that on it. It was something the company did. It was silly. She'll bother you. You're sick of it. Hey, come on now. Come on, go lay down, Chloe. Please. Go lay down. Huh? Now you go lay down.
Okay.
Well, I miss my dog.
Oh, well, she'll be here.
When I worked for the Railroad Commission, when I quit, the fellow that replaced me was a fellow by the name of Hanson. He's now dead, but he was Alex Hansen's younger brother, and you know Alex with the county organization.
Yeah.
And he went to law school. I think he was a freshman the year I was a senior, but he was one of the editors at the Missoulian. That's the way he worked his way through school. And I'm not sure just how long after he got out of law school, but he worked for the Anaconda Company for a good many years after that, after he retired from his job at the Railroad Commission. It wasn't a big paying job, but it was a lot of fun. I'll tell you, if you've never toured Montana with Austin Middleton, you don't realize what a good, great, different experience that might be.
I'm trying to remember. Austin Middleton had some connection to Jimmy Carter.
His son,
Blue Middleton,
was Jimmy Carter's roommate at the Naval Academy.
Okay.
And
I've heard of, you know, Austin Middleton's kind of a memorable name. It's a, you know, slightly unusual name, so it's one that sticks with you. And I've heard that name has popped up at different times in my life. And he was a public service commissioner when in the 40s and 50s? Or?
Austin was an old rancher from the Miles City area, a cowboy. He ran away. He was born in Minnesota, and he ran away from home. His parents died. He was left without parents, and he lived with a sister in Minnesota, I think in the suburbs of Minneapolis. And his brother was a drove the stagecoach from Miles City to Deadwood, South Dakota. And he ran away from home because this sounded like very romantic stuff. And they agreed that he could stay in Miles City if he'd finish high school. And he did. And
this would have been back around the turn of the century?
Back around the turn of the century. I think Austin was born, I believe he was born in like 87, 89, something like that.
Yeah.
And he was not very old when he ran away from home. Ran away from his sister's home. Found his brother. Lived in Miles City. He was very well thought of in Miles City. He'd been a good baseball player, and they had a baseball team at that time. I don't know what year it was, but they had a sheriff that nobody liked, and a bunch of the local people got Austin to run for sheriff, and he won an election. He ran as a Democrat. Now Austin was about as far from it. He was not a liberal in any sense of the word.
Uh-huh.
A very conservative man. And he really was kind of apolitical. He didn't. The story about him I always loved was when Paul Smith first ran for the commission, somebody, and probably some of the people from Butte, asked Austin if he would take him with him. And so when they went campaigning, you go campaigning on a big long trip with Austin, it's likely to kill you. He could drink more whiskey than anybody I ever saw in my life, and I never saw him drunk.
Huh.
He was. Did you know Newell Goff here in Helena?
I'm not sure I ever met him.
Well, Newell was a big man,
uh-huh.
Very big, and Newell liked to tip a few at times, and he was always taking on Austin. He's going to drink him under the table, and he never won one of those fights. Anyway, Austin took Paul Smith campaigning, and they get down east of Billings there, or around Billings, and he told Paul, he said, I see you cleaning your fingernails every now and then. And Paul said, yeah. And he said, well, here, when we're down in this country, do it with this. And Austin was a Mason, and he handed him a knife, a little pen knife that had a Masonic emblem on it. Well, Paul was Catholic. So as they campaigned down through Miles City and so forth, he'd clean his fingernails with this Masonic emblem on the knife, and everybody down there thought he must be a Mason.
Which would have been good for him politically?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Down in that country. That was pretty solid Republican and conservative, and they didn't. The Catholic with Butte.
Yeah.
If you were Butte, well, you were.
Sure.
You were Catholic. Paul was an awful nice fellow, too. I thought a lot of Paul Smith. But they.
You've told me some things about the whiskey drinking exploits of Austin Middleton, and he sounds like a colorful character.
Oh, yeah.
But I think I've had his name brought up to me, I don't know, at least a half a dozen times in my life, and he's probably been dead for 30 years. So what is it about him that's fixed in your memory? How would you describe him?
I'll tell you what a guy said one time that always impressed me. Charlie Schofield was a long-term Republican politician from Powder River County.
State senator for a fair amount of time.
Senator for a long time, through a bunch of strange events. He was the Speaker of the House of Representatives, I think, in 1935, 1937.
Huh.
You think, right in the middle of the Depression, where did these Republicans come from? Well,
yeah.
The Democrats, there were a lot of counties around here where the socialists had run for legislation and get elected. The Democrats would have to vote for a Republican to keep him from sending this guy to Helena. They did elect a communist. The guy ran on the communist ticket up in the northeastern Montana.
Yeah, up in the Plentywood country.
Yeah.
I think,
yeah. And
Red Flag. leg Taylor, as I recall.
I think that's right. and wonderful old fellow. But, you know, a dyed-in-the-wool Republican, and he had been a friend of Austin's. And he said one time, you know, if I really got in trouble, or I was in deep trouble over something, he said, the first guy I'd go to would be Austin Mills. And I think that's right. If you needed a friend, Austin was a friend. If you were his friend,
he was a loyal friend.
He was very loyal. Now, he might do awful things to you, you know, in the process.
Practical jokes?
Yes, and you'd be walking down the street, and somebody would say, hey, Austin, how are you? And they'd come over, and he'd introduce me to them. And they know my name, but I haven't got the slightest idea what his name was. And when they'd greet each other like brothers. And when you'd walk away from him, he didn't know what the guy's name was. He had no idea. Prisoners. He'd been warden of the penitentiary.
Middleton was at one time the state prison warden?
Yes. And he was appointed by Elmer Holt.
Also from Miles City.
Also from Miles City.
He'd been a state senator from there and ended up governor.
Yeah. And he knew Austin. And they got they had driven Frank Connolly he used to run the prison on a business basis.
He had a big ranch in that area and was also the prison warden.
That's right. And he kept the prisoners for so much a day. And that wasn't an unusual arrangement in the West. That was normal. Well, they finally ended that, which really probably isn't a good idea. They had ended that. And then they had all kinds of trouble with the prison. They had a riot a month over there. And they went through, I don't remember what the number was, but there were three or four wardens in a very short period of time after they got rid of Connolly, because all of these guys that worked in the prison were all Connolly's men. You know, mm-hmm. And they'd stir it up if nobody else did. When they'd had another event of some sort, not very long after Elmer Holt became governor, and he appointed Austin the warden, and Austin went over to there to be warden, and when he kind of got to know the help over there. It was getting in the fall, and there were a lot of laid-off cowboys down around Miles City, so he knew, of course, everybody down there. Well, he just got a whole bunch of them to come over, and they signed on as prison guards. And, of course, they were tougher than the prisoners in there by far. There's a lot of stories about the prison. Middleton had broken his leg, and a horse got up against him in a corral, and he limped the rest of his life. He had this bad leg. And he was just getting over that when he went over there to be the warden. And he was on crutches. And he walked in, and a prisoner came walking up to him and said, "Hiya, warden." He said, "I'm the con boss around here." And Midland said, there isn't any con boss anymore in this prison. And the guy said something kind of rough to him. Milton just crowned him with a crutch. hit him right over the head with a crutch. And that, it kind of went that way. He had all those cowboys working, and they got control of the prison in a hurry. And he was a very successful administrator of the prison.
But when that would have been?
Well, that was in the 30s.
The 30s?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because Elmer Holt was governor, I think, in the late 30s.
Yeah. Well, it was a late 30 or early 30.
Could be. Yep. Because I think, let's see, Erickson was elected in 32, and his lieutenant governor was Cooney, and Cooney died in office, and then Elmer Holt finished out the term. So it was probably 35, 36 right in there.
That's when Erickson appointed himself senator.
That's when Erickson appointed himself senator.
And nobody liked that very well.
Right.
But then Elmer Holt was the president pro tem of the Senate.
Yep.
And just to this funny thing, he then succeeded.
But did you know Elmer Holt?
No. Bob Corrett was married to Elmer Holt's daughter, Lori. But no, I think Elmer Holt probably was dead before I was around. I started to the law school in 1950.
I see.
So that dated me and my experience in Montana.
You probably went to law school at roughly the same time Jim Lucas did?
Jim was a year ahead of me, and we had a class together. Jim would get to playing baseball in the spring, and he'd kind of lose track of it. And of course, Dean Liepart loved Jim Lucas. Lucas could get away with stuff that nobody else could. Dean Liepart loved him, and I think they all recognized the talent that Jim had. And Jim is an extraordinary lawyer, and I've had, well, starting back with Wes Castles.
Wes Castles was a justice of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and also
served on Governor Aaronson's staff.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, Jim Lucas later became Speaker of the House.
Right, right. Lucas, a terrific guy. I guess it would have been Judge, long retired, still lives in Helena, was a Democrat.
Gordon Bennett?
No, not Gordon. I can't say his name. I see him at the Carroll football games all the time.
Was a Supreme Court justice?
Yes.
John Harrison,
yeah. And when I was working for the Railroad Commission, I used to love to go up and I'd sit down and get a lot of information from John Harrison. He liked to talk. Anyway, I'm sure it was John and Wes Stewart. Both of them said to me that the best appellate practitioner, the guy who spoke in the court, who argued cases in the Supreme Court, that Lucas was the best by far.
Really?
In the state, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, Wes Stewart was a congressman at one time.
Yeah.
In the 50s.
Yeah.
Was he a lawyer?
Did I say Wes? I meant Wes Castles.
Wes Castles, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, Wes Stewart was, I think when I came in 1950, I think Wes Stewart was a congressman.
Yeah, he was a congressman. Yeah. Well, I knew Wes Castles a little bit, too. But Jim Lucas was a wonderfully gifted state legislator also.
Yeah, he was.
And I think we all thought he'd be governor. And he came a cropper of that sales tax.
Sales tax, yeah, which is a shame. Of course, starting about the time that I got into being interested in state government in Montana, which might have been while I was in law school, you always wonder why they haven't got a sales tax here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still wondering about it.
It's just really been a traditional thing to be opposed to it.
I know it. And it runs in the same category, as far as I'm concerned, as people that don't want to have a seatbelt law. It may be a bad idea, actually, to pass a seatbelt law, because I'm convinced, if anybody reads the newspaper, there was this accident last weekend, where the woman died and they had a baby strapped in the car, was unhurt. When they look at the evidence of how you can save your life with a seatbelt, you got to think that we're improving the gene pool if we just don't have a seatbelt law.
For sure. Did you know Governor Aaronson?
I wasn't a friend of his or anything, but I was around when he was governor. Yeah.
You mentioned too that someone that I just have a very vague memory of as a kid was Ori Armstrong. Mm-hmm. Ori was a prominent member of the legislature from Flathead County, and was Speaker of the House for a while.
Yeah.
And I was just a little kid. I was interested in politics, though, and I remember vaguely who he was. But he then went on to be appointed to the Public Service Commission when you worked there.
Yeah.
Do you have any impressions of him?
Yeah, he was. Ori was a really nice guy, and a very intelligent man. But I don't. I kind of think maybe that somebody leaned on him to take that job.
Yeah.
I don't think he wanted to do that. He was retired, you know.
I see.
Almost totally, I think.
Now he was a tribal member, I think, because I remember he was a member of the Flathead Tribe.
He could have been. He could have been.
I think he was.
Yeah. Yes. I don't know that.
Yeah.
But, you know, Ori was, you know, he was easy to get along with, very intelligent guy, hardworking, stuck to business, but he didn't seem to be totally interested.
Was Frank Hazelbaker on the Supreme or on the Public Service Commission for a while?
Yes, he was. He was.
Also by appointment?
Yes, I think he was appointed.
So he probably wasn't there very long?
He wasn't there very long, no. And I don't, that was after I was, after I had left. Might not have been very long after I left. I think maybe Hazelbaker, I'm pretty sure. I think Frank was appointed to replace Leonard Young.
Okay.
And Leonard Young had died.
Now, Leonard Young is another name I remember, but I don't remember knowing him. Any thoughts or comments about Leonard Young?
Yeah, I'll tell you. I've been a Republican all my life, and that almost changed me. Leonard Young, I had absolutely no respect for him. He was a bad guy.
Terms of personal honesty, or?
Well, I don't know that he was personally dishonest at all. He wasn't a team player. He was very underhanded how he picked on everybody else. And he picked on me. And he picked on me because Middleton liked me, I'm sure. And he and Middleton, I mean, you put him in, well, I'll tell you. The big church service up on the west side here when Leonard Young died. And Paul and Leonard Young, or Paul and Austin and I went to the services. And we were sitting there, and Austin had a stage whisper that you could hear across the highway. And we were sitting there, and I was in the middle, and Austin's on one side, me and Paul was on the other. And a guy got up and gave a eulogy of Leonard Young. Talked about what a great God-fearing man he was, a superhuman being, and just everything about him. He got about halfway through this, and Middleton leaned over and said to Paul Smith, "Where's the wrong service?"
And other people probably heard it.
Oh, yeah, a lot of people. They do things to Leonard that just uncanny. The two of them thought just alike. We'd been down in Billings for some hearings, and Leonard Young wasn't around as far as I know. I don't know whether he was coming later or something. And we went down, and Arthur Lamy, who was Paul Smith thought Art Lamy was a saint. He said, "Man ought to be sanctified."
Why do I know that name?
Well, that's Jim Hoy's old firm. When I went down to Billings out of law school, it was Coleman, Lamy, and Jameson.
So Arthur Lamy was a prominent attorney in Billings?
Yeah, very prominent, yeah.
And why was Paul Smith so...
Well, he was a friend. Art had been a friend of his.
I see.
And he just idolized him. He said, "It's the greatest man, should have been governor." He was... And Art Lamy was an awful nice person. He was not, he wasn't an aggressive person at all. He was really nice. And of course, he had lost a leg in World War I. We had been to Art Lamy's house for dinner. And we came back downtown, walked in the Northern Hotel. There was a county commissioner's convention going on, and of course, Middleton and Smith, I think that's why Leonard wasn't there. They had come down a day or two early because they were campaigning all the time. I mean, they Well, when you traveled with him, you had every bar, every tavern in the state. I mean, there are bars that I can still remember being in. I didn't want to be in. And I couldn't, Austin, I couldn't keep up with them.
They'd go into the bar and
campaign with them. Buy a drink, you know, but they knew every bartender, every bar owner. And especially in labor towns like Great Falls.
Now, they're both Democrats.
They were both Democrats.
And I think of Paul Smith maybe as being a little more of a liberal and regular Democrat.
Than he would have been a more regular Democrat. He was a New Deal Democrat, a Roosevelt Democrat.
Did they vote alike on the Public Service Commission?
Oh, just exactly alike, yeah. Yeah, there's no, I don't ever remember. Well, no. No, that's right. I don't ever remember him voting differently. Paul Smith had a thing. Now, he wasn't a mean guy at all. He was nothing vindictive about Paul. He forgive and forgive. But he wanted the 10-cent phone call. Public telephones ought to be a dime. And Montana was a dime long after it was 2 bits every place in the United States. And Paul wouldn't let him raise the rates. He was always turning them down on the coin machine. It ought to be a dime. Make a local call for 10 cents.
Yeah.
But
now there were 3 public service commissioners.
Yeah.
And so, you know, now I don't know, this is just, I guess, kind of part of the folklore of Montana. You mentioned when you were in law school that they used to blame everything on the Anaconda Company. And I think it was kind of popular to blame things on the Montana Power Company, too. They were a kind of a whipping boy company also.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, and the Public Service Commission, could you maybe talk a little bit about your impressions of did the Montana Power Company exert a great deal of influence? If so, how? What was their strategy?
They exerted a lot of influence on the Railroad Commission, but they didn't.
The Public Service Commission used to be called the Railroad Commission.
Yeah,
okay.
Railroad and Public Service Commission.
Okay.
And didn't spend much time on the power company. You know, if they'd have a rate increase, then there would be a big, of course, big hearings. They only had one general rate increase. I might stand to be corrected. My memory isn't always good, but I think we only had one rather large case during the time I was on it, and that's that. It wasn't a big thing at all. So I never really saw it when it was an important thing.
Well, were there people say from the Northern Pacific Railroad, or the Great Northern, or the Montana Power Company, maybe lobbyists or representatives from those companies who paid close attention to Paul Smith and Austin Middleton and Leonard Young? Would they have taken them to lunch frequently and that type of thing and lobbied them?
Yeah, they could have, but normally it was when you were having a hearing someplace, and then it would be the Northern Pacific was represented in Montana principally by Cret Smith and Dean and
Bob Cret's law firm out of Dean.
Yeah, Kendrick Smith.
Yeah,
who was a wonderful lawyer, and Harold Dean, who'd been a lawyer, I think it's Superior over in the west end of the state someplace. He was an older fellow, but a nice gentleman. These were old-time lawyers. They were, you know, it was a different breed of cat than you got now. I mean, you didn't have to worry about them quite as much as you should worry about them now. And I say that even though my son is a lawyer. And practicing in Billings, but and I've got a lot of friends that are lawyers. But the law has changed and the methods have changed, and I think it was better before. You asked me about the papers. Yeah. You know, the Anaconda Company owned all the papers in the state. Well, I think they were better papers than they are now. I don't know how you put out a worse paper than the Independent Record. You'd have to be trying to put out a worse newspaper than that. And it, you know, even after Lee bought it, it was a good newspaper. But it is bad now. I mean, that's an awful rag.
You mean in terms of its editorial?
Well, of course, I don't agree with the editorial policy, but I didn't agree with the editorial policy of the Missoulian, but it's a good newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why they all think they have to be liberal. I think that's just Lee newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
They were, so everybody else is, like your boss. But the Missoulian, they do a good job, I think. And I never, and I love newspapers. I read every line in the newspaper.
Yeah, I enjoy newspapers too.
But the Independent Record, God, they can screw up a story. It's awful.
Now, Jim, you left the PSC, what, about 1960?
No, I was only there 3 years. I worked for them from 54 to 57. And I left just before I left in December of 56. And then I worked during the legislature for the Montana Motor Transport Association.
Okay, so you would have worked with Leonard Eccles?
Yes, worked with Leonard. Leonard was a very good friend of mine.
And he was an important fundraiser for Republican candidates and things like that?
Yeah, and
that?
Democrats. Oh. Leonard was kind of biased. He was AC/DC in that respect. He had a lot. He originally was a Democrat, of course, and he worked for the Railroad Commission in the 30s.
I see.
He was, I don't know what kind of a title he had, but he...
Well, I know he raised money for Tim Babcock.
Oh, yeah. He and
of course, Tim was a trucker, so that...
Yeah,
the
and that's where the connection was. But, Leonard... I think Leonard, if they were friendly to the truckers, then Leonard would help them. Leonard was a great friend of Forrest Anderson's. He didn't pick any fight with anybody.
Sure.
Leonard was a good association executive.
And he was also a lobbyist.
Yeah.
And apparently a fairly shrewd one, from
you
what
bet.
I say.
You bet. What was the
key to his effectiveness as a lobbyist?
Well, I think he knew his business, and he knew people. And he didn't just know them during the legislature. He knew them all year round. And he whined and dined people. But I think Leonard's effectiveness was that he was one-sided to the extent that he was interested in truckers' welfare. As long as somebody was decent to the Motor Transport Association, they were friends of Leonard.
Sure. And so you assisted him as a lobbyist in 59?
Well, no, I just I read bills for him.
I see.
In 57. They had, Idaho had passed a 10-mile tax, which, I got to be an awfully good friend of Charlie Bowlby's during that session.
Now, Charlie Bowlby was a state senator from Great Falls.
Great Falls, Democrat.
Yeah.
And also a great guy, I thought. And Charlie asked me one day, why do the truckers hate the 10-mile tax so much? And he said, well, I don't think they hate it any worse than they'd hate any other additional tax you were going to put on them. It was a thing, and they didn't like it at all. And it was kind of a thing with them. There's a good story about that. There was a guy that was he was the head of the highway patrol in Idaho, And he had been a big proponent in Idaho of the 10-mile tax, and had what business that was. Of course, they were, you know, I think in Idaho they manned the way stations and so forth, and I suppose he had something to do with it to that extent. But why in the world he would have been so involved that he was, and he was very political. And after they had passed that tax sometime during the year, this was probably 55, that might have been 59, might have been 57 too. It was 57, he had become a field man representative for the Highway Safety Foundation, and he was down in the hotel, and Leonard was sitting up with somebody in the balcony there. I don't know, you probably haven't spent a lot of time in what's the name?
Old Placer Hotel.
Placer Hotel. That was during the legislative sessions in the old days. That was the place. But it had a balcony over the lobby. And Leonard was up there, and he was watching this guy, and he was going around, and he was talking to a bunch of legislators. And Leonard gets in his head, this guy is, he's promoting a 10-mile tax. And the fellow was a representative from here. He was a real character. I'd have to think a long time.
Ray Weirden? Ray Weirden?
No.
Actually, earlier than that. Huh?
Earlier than that, yeah. Leonard gets the idea he's promoting this 10-mile tax. So he hops on back in the office, calls the national guy that was head of the Truckers Association, the National Truckers Association. Leonard's raising hell. Said, you get over there and tell them, because the motor transport people were probably the most influential thing there was in the highway safety programs. At least they furnished a lot of the money. And he said, yeah, get that son of a bitch over here. He's promoting the 10-mile tax. He had asked this legislator what that guy was talking about, and he told him that. He said, oh, he's promoting this 10-mile tax, and I'm kind of leaning his way now, you know. And he was pulling Leonard's leg. And Leonard fired right up, and he calls his national chairman, raises hell with him. The guy gets a telegram that night, I guess, and delivered the next morning, told him, you get out of town, it's too hot there or something. And they didn't know that he was doing this, but they didn't want to take a chance on him. The poor guy had to leave town. And I remember Leonard was saying, my God, you saw what I took care of that problem in a hurry. And about that time, this legislator from Billings said, that guy called me on the telephone, and he said he just wanted to say goodbye. And he said he didn't know why he was leaving town exactly, but they had told him that he shouldn't be meddling in this truck tax stuff in Montana. And Leonard said, and of course he put two and two together, and he said, you didn't believe what I told you, did you? And Leonard said, well, yeah, I believed you. And he said, he wasn't talking about that. He was talking about some highway safety program. Leonard had him run out of town. God, I wish I could remember his name. He played golf. He was a big man, and I think union.
A legislator from Butte?
Yeah, and a good guy. He was a lot of fun. In those days, you know, when you think about the Placer Hotel, you always think about the fact that the Anaconda Company and the railroads had a watering hole there.
Yeah.
A hospitality room. And in later years, those were condemned broadly, you know, what kind of stuff is that? That's what do. They'd go over there and get Pete Legislator drunk and get him to go vote. Well, nobody ever got drunk in the daytime. They did get a lot of fun. In those days, you know, when you think about the Placer Hotel, you always think about the fact that the Anaconda Company and the railroads had a watering hole there.
Yeah.
A hospitality room. And these, in later years, those were condemned broadly. You know, what kind of stuff is that? That's what these lobbyists do. They go over there and get Pete Legislator drunk and get them to go vote. Well, nobody ever got drunk in the daytime. They did get a little tipsy at night, maybe now and then. And when I went over in 59 for one of the petroleum associations.
As a lobbyist? Then?
As a lobbyyist, yeah. And Basil Ander Copolis, I don't know if you've ever
been
into Basil.
That's another name, kind of like Austin Middleton that I've heard of. I've heard Gene Turnage mention him.
Yeah. Well, Basil was, he was an interesting guy. He worked for one of the petroleum organizations, and we worked together. We did everything together at the legislature. And
he was a lawyer?
No.
But he was a lobbyist for...
He ran the Montana... What the hell was the name of the outfit? It was the... I guess that was the Rocky Mountain Petroleum Association,
okay.
And they had a Montana section, and that's where the independents, that was the organization that the independent petroleum people belonged to.
Okay.
And I worked for the Montana Petroleum Association, which really represented the major companies because those were the people who were marketing and refining in the state. But our interests were very similar, and it kind of gave us two lobbyists for the session.
Jim, were there any, and now you lobbied what, in 59 and 61?
59, 61, 63, 65.
And then for petroleum, primarily?
Yeah.
And then you went to work in the Babcock administration?
Yeah, in 65, after the session.
I see.
It was the middle of the summer.
So you were there when the watering holes were in existence?
You bet.
You saw...
Well, Basil and I ran one.
Jorgensen's. The petroleum?
Yeah, we had the petroleum room, they used to call it.
Yeah. So tell me, how did you run that? What did you do? When did it open? When did it close?
It opened 5 o'clock in the afternoon, 6 o'clock, as soon as there would be people around. Because while they were in session, we were in the Capitol.
Sure.
And then we'd go down and we'd get some ice. And we had a big supply of booze. Tony Cullum, I don't know if you ever knew Tony. That Tony's bar here in town.
Okay.
He ran the bar in Jorgensen's, and he checked our room for us every day and stocked it. And
did you serve any food?
No. Well, we might have something now and then, but we didn't serve any food. We might have. I don't ever remember whether we had snacks in there or not. I think people might bring stuff now and then, but I don't. That wasn't a. It wasn't a big thing.
It was mainly where at the end of the day a legislator or legislators could drop in, have a cocktail, sit down in a soft chair, and kind of unwind.
Right, right. That's all it was for. And we did our best. We worked harder at encouraging Democrats to come up there than we did Republicans. And because we had to get to know people. And one way to get to know them is, you know, have a drink with them, sit around and talk.
Yeah.
And
did you lobby them then when they were there?
No, that was kind of one of the rules was you didn't lobby somebody in a hospitality room. If they guy'd ask you a question, you'd answer.
That's what
question.
I was thinking. If some guy came in and said, "Hey Jim or Hey Basil, you know, I don't really understand this new tertiary recovery legislation, and I'm not sure exactly how the severance tax applies. Can you tell me about
it?
Then
you would tell.
Yeah.
And the other thing about lobbying, people get such a distorted view of what it is and why. All you had to do was go up here and lie to a congressman, a legislator once, and you were all done. That was, you couldn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
And the minute you did that, you were all through.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's paying attention to you. And that's when I was saying, when I got well acquainted with Charlie Bowie, when he asked me that question, I told him, it's just, Charlie, it's money. And they don't like it any better, any worse than any other tax. But they have this kind of thing about it. Well, he always appreciated that.
Yeah.
That I'd tell him.
Yeah.
Tell him.
They just want to pay more taxes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think there was bribery? Do you think there was anything like that went on?
If it did, I never saw it. I never knew it. In the first place, most people elected to the legislature are unusual people to start with. They're kind of cream of the crop. It's gone downhill recently, I think, but when I was around it, these were community leaders.
Pretty prominent citizens.
Pretty prominent citizens. And, they didn't go in for that. And you sure as hell couldn't influence them to vote by buying them a drink or dinner or something.
Yeah.
I remember.
What did you think you had to gain then? Or what do you think the Anaconda Company or the railroads felt they had to gain by having these hospitality meetings?
To get to know a legislator so you could talk to him and be honest with him.
Sure.
And not worry about him double crossing you.
Just establish a relationship.
Just establish a relationship. And the best thing that it did was that, Republicans and the Democrats didn't fight like they do now. It was a much more collegial atmosphere. And one of my old friends that I see now and then down in Townsend is Pat Hooks. I don't know if you ever knew Pat.
Okay.
Pat came over when there were a bunch of kind of freshman Republicans in the legislature. Jerry Anderson from Billings, Henry Lobel, Gene Peacock. Now Henry Lobel was him. Gene Peacock was the guy. Really. Pat Hooks.
Pat was a young legislator, just one or two terms from Broadwater County.
Right.
So he maybe back in the early 60s.
Right. Probably late 50s, early 60s.
Okay.
They were Democrats and Republicans, and they worked together. I mean, they did things together.
Yeah.
They didn't.
When I came to the legislature much later, but in 1971, there was a much more collegial environment than there is now.
Oh, yeah.
And it started to deteriorate, I think, pretty rapidly, in the late 80s, early 90s. Any thoughts on why that is?
I don't know. I think part of it is this part that they don't get to know each other.
The term limitations maybe cut down on
that. Well, that would have had some effect on it, all right, because you didn't build up a...
Yeah.
A guy that you, that here in Helena, that you might perhaps talk to is, he was in the House from Raleigh County.
Norris Nichols?
Norris Nichols.
Yeah.
Norris Nichols was a Republican. Bill Groff was a Democrat.
Right.
Norris Nichols ran financial matters in the House, and Bill Groff ran financial matters in the Senate. And those two guys did more good things for the state of Montana than anybody will ever give them credit for.
They called them the Gold Dust Twins. I remember that. And Bill Groff was chairman of the Senate Finance Committee.
That's right.
And the Norris Nichols was chairman of the House Appropriations
Committee.
And there was a period of time there when the Republicans had the majority for several sessions in a row in the House and the Democrats in the Senate. So it turned out that Bill and Norris, who both represented the same people, the same area, were the... And of course, they had a very good working relationship.
And Bill Groff off at just the sound of the Rock of Gibraltar, and didn't go for any of this goofy stuff.
Yeah.
And Norris was a, Norris knew what he was doing. And it, but you don't have that anymore. I don't know of any, of course I'm not around the legislature either. There may be some working up there that I don't know anything about. But in those days there were a lot of combinations, you know, of Democrat and Republican legislators who had something to accomplish, and they worked together to get it done.
Yeah.
One of the reasons was a lot of them, they got to know each other in those hospitality rooms. And I don't think these people now know each other very well. There's no social basis for contact between Democrats and Republicans. And to me, I guess it's, the world has passed me by long ago. I was more comfortable 40, 50 years ago than I am now. How would you go up there and get along with Ms. Kaufman, for example? That's just so far out there that I don't,
Representative Christine Kaufman from Helena?
Yes. I mean, that one, I don't know how I would do it. But I can remember when Bertha
Streeter?
From Polson.
Yeah, I think Bertha Streeter.
Bertha Streeter.
Yeah.
When she was in
the Senate. The member of the Senate from Lake County.
Yeah. She came up and have a drink, and she kind of talked like the man, really. it was funny. But now you get to know her, but it was a different, the legislators were a lot friendlier with each other. They weren't afraid of each other. I think they're scared to death of each other now, I go over there and tell that guy something, he'll cut my throat. And it's a shame, because I don't think it's good for the, state.
Well, I think there's a higher level of partisanship now, and I think you're right. I think they don't know each other as well, and very possibly the passing by the wayside of the watering holes had something to do with it, and I think the fact that nobody can be there for longer than 8 years limits their opportunity to get to know each other, too.
That's good.
But I think that there's been some discussion, too, that I've been involved in, and I believe it to be true. There used to be a virtue to be able to work with the other side.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be something that you took pride in. If you were a Republican, you had many friends on the Democratic side of the aisle. And that was honored around the legislative chambers. Now, you're not a true believer, you're sort of a Benedict Arnold.
Suspect.
Yeah, you're sort of suspect, and there's a much sharper division between the two parties now. And fraternizing between the lines is looked down on, where before it wasn't so much the case.
Right.
I mean, as you mentioned, Norris Nichols and Bill Groff were held out as good examples of a couple of guys that worked well together, and there was mutual respect and friendship, and they made things happen in a positive way. And now I think that would be seen as some kind of almost dishonest collaboration.
and I'm sure tournaments have something to do with that, because people got to know each other, a lot of those people that were very influential and did know a lot of people on the other side of the aisle were old timers there. What was the old fellow's name from Prairie County? I'm sure he was there.
Dave Manning?
Dave Manning.
Yeah.
Dave was, kind of like your grandfather.
Yeah. Well, I knew him very well. I knew him very well. He had thick glasses.
Mm-hmm.
He'd had some kind of an operation on his eyes, and so he had those very thick glasses lenses, and he was quite elderly. In fact, his first session in the legislature, I think, was 1933. And so I remember Dave and I served on the taxation committee together for a couple of sessions in the 1970s, probably 1980. And he you couldn't always tell if his eyes were open or closed because his glasses lenses were so thick. But there were certain things that Dave paid meticulous attention to. Highways, water, coal, things that pertain to his part of the state.
Yeah.
And if anything like that would come up, boy, Dave would be on top of it in an instant in the committee. But if the discussion was on things that didn't particularly pertain to him, you couldn't even tell if he was asleep or awake.
Yeah.
But boy, he was awake plenty when it pertained to him.
I think maybe that's probably a point. Maybe these people pay too much attention to things that don't actually affect their their constituents quite like they.
Yeah.
They should. There's more of a. Well,
you know, do you have any impressions of Governor Nutter?
Yeah, Don was a good friend of mine.
Describe him.
Don was a, well, you know that he was a, he had been a, I think the best description of Don was he had been a high school athletic official for years. And, you know, he didn't mind calling fouls on the popular player of the hometown team. Don was a tough guy. He wasn't nothing namby pamby about Don. He was a very, very straight up, straightforward, honest, decent person. And he'd been a successful businessman in Sydney. He was in the implement business. And he sold it and came over to the university and went to law school. Now, Don was a year behind me, too, at school. And in 1953, he asked Dean Leifart, and there were three or four of us, if we could come over to the legislature for a couple of weeks and help him out. And the Dean said, sure. I got out of school for a couple of weeks and came over and kind of worked as his clerk.
What was Leifart doing at the legislature?
No, he was at the law school.
Yeah.
And we were still in school.
Don Nutter asked if a couple of you law students could come over and
help
kind of assist him. I got you. Okay.
And the dean approved it. Don was an extraordinary guy and a real loss for the state when he got killed, because he'd have been governor for a couple of terms, and then he'd have been a senator from still there. Don was a wonderful guy.
Well, what was it about him that was
well,
impressive?
He was intelligent. He was tough. What you see is what you got, and he told people, you know, what he was thinking. He wasn't devious in any respect at all. But he was a damn smart guy, very capable guy.
Very conservative.
Yeah, he wasn't as conservative as they made him out to be. I remember I was always going to, sometime when the opportunity came about, I was going to call Malone up, tell him that he ought to rewrite his two or three paragraphs on Nutter and the university system. And that goofy president down there ran against him.
Roland Rennie. Yeah.
Well,
he ran against Babcock, though, I think, in 64, didn't he? Nutter beat Paul Cannon in 1960. With Babcock as his running mate.
Well, Babcock ran for lieutenant governor. This all happened in 1960.
Yeah.
I thought that Nutter beat.
No, Nutter beat Paul Cannon in 1960. And then Rennie ran against Babcock in 64.
remember that. Anyway, Rennie must have done what he did some campaigning against Nutter.
I'm sure, yeah.
When Nutter, when Don ran. And so when Don was elected, Rennie came over, called and made an appointment to talk about things that affected the MSU and the university system. And he got through telling Nutter what he ought to do about all of this, and Don said, well, one thing you ought to do is start looking for another job.
He was pretty matter of fact, huh?
Yes. Smooth. Yes. Which I guess just offended hell out of Rennie. But I mean, that's the way Don was. He was up front about things. Tough, but he was up front. Again, nothing devious about Don.
Good public speaker?
Good public speaker. Good public speaker.
Sense of humor?
Good, great sense of humor. Great sense of humor.
How did he and Babcock get teamed up?
You know, I don't know, except, of course, Tim, when he ran for lieutenant governor, he was from Miles City. And I suppose the just dean from Eastern Montana associated him a bit. And I don't think before Tim ran, I don't think he and Nutter were particular friends at all. I think they became friends when they ran.
Mm-hmm.
And
how did you then end up going to work for Babcock?
Well, I was, my wife and I had been separated. And my first wife, my bed. Mm-hmm. And I really kind of wanted to get out of Billings. It was a little uncomfortable. And '68, of course, Tim had been elected governor, and I can't remember exactly what. Anyway, he was putting a staff together, and Jack
Hallowell
had agreed to come on, and they.
And Jack Hallowell was what, chief of staff?
Jack was. Well, they had two positions there. They had what did they call it, Jack? I was the administrative assistant to Tim, I think it was, and Hallowell was the Jack, of course, was the he did all the press stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he traveled more with Tim than I did. I don't know how business got divided up there, to tell you the truth.
But you worked in that position in the Babcock administration for what, several years?
Well, I worked there all through Tim's term there. Yeah. Not the 2 years that he.
Any stories? Any experiences? Anything that stand out in your mind from those years?
I'll tell you, I worked so hard. I can't really remember. We had a big dust up with Ted James.
What happened there? Ted James was the lieutenant governor.
Ted James was lieutenant governor, and Ted James. Now there's another guy that isn't a team player. He was always tooting on his own horn, and if he wanted to kind of twist Tim's tail a little, of course he'd get his brother Scotty.
Scotty was the editor at the Great Falls Tribune.
And I have always thought people looked down on Tim because he was not well educated. They thought he was somehow he was, you know, lowbrow. He wasn't smart enough to be governor.
Mm-hmm.
And I do. I think they looked down on him. And Tim's English, you know, wasn't the greatest, and he really wasn't a good speaker because of that. Mm-hmm. Limited resources for speaking, but. I think that's the way most of them felt.
So Ted James, Tim's lieutenant governor, ran against him in the Republican primary for governor. I believe that occurred in 1968.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
Tim was out of town. He was out of the country. I can't remember exactly. Hey. I can't remember exactly what those circumstances were, but he was either out of the country or out of the state. I think he was out of the country. And a guy died that had been on the Public Service Commission. And we were trying to, you know, I think we had somebody found Tim thought was a good choice. And Ted James, he's lieutenant governor, Tim's out of state, he's going to appoint whoever the hell he wanted to, and he did. And that doesn't, you know, that really didn't go over very
good. The appointment stick?
Oh, yeah.
I think I remember something about that. Yeah.
Because he is. He's the acting governor. He's got the power to do it.
Would that have been Ernie Steele?
I think maybe it was Ernie Steele. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but Ernie Steele was from Great Falls.
Yeah,
I think that's it. Yeah. Yeah. Tim. One thing I always give Tim credit for, he's very good about appointing the judges. And politics didn't enter into it.
Mm-hmm.
And there were several guys who had, well, I think maybe some of them had started when Arnold Olson was Attorney General, actually. But they never worked for a Republican in that time. Some of them had worked for Fort Anderson and actually were working for him when he appointed him to a judgeship. But they were people that got the backing of the local lawyers in the area. And I think he did a good job. He didn't, he was very, very cognizant of that. He didn't think that politics should matter in that affair. And one time it was really kind of uncomfortable. Trying to think of the guy's name, I can't say it. He was in Forrest Anderson's, I think maybe he was Forrest Anderson's first assistant.
Ron Richards?
No. I hope we didn't appoint Ron Richards to anything. I never thought much of him. This fellow was from I can't.
Oh, when Anderson was Attorney General. This guy was an assistant to Anderson.
Yeah.
An assistant attorney general, and then Tim appointed him judge.
Tim appointed him a judge at Forsyth.
Okay.
And he was a Forsyth boy.
Okay.
And Lucas had a lot of influence on that.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who had been in the Senate from that county, I'm starting to think of what county it is, Forsyth.
Rosebud.
Rosebud. Had been in the legislature. He'd been a senator for years. He'd been the chairman of the judicial committee in the Senate, Fred. And he, of course, wanted the job. And he was a mean son.
Hmm.
He wasn't a nice man.
Hmm.
And the lawyers down there didn't want him.
Hmm.
A lot of them had you know, he had a lot of old enmities over lawsuits and one thing and another that didn't heal right. Most of the time, you know, two lawyers can have a hell of a battle in a courtroom and still remain personal friends.
Yeah.
He didn't. When you had a lawsuit with him, well, you were, had a vendetta for the rest of your life. Some people are like that.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Dunkel was like that. Frank couldn't have a disagreement with anybody without starting a vendetta.
Yeah.
He was that way.
He was Babcock's Fish and Game.
Fish and Game.
Yeah. And then later served in the state senate.
Yeah.
Ran for governor.
He would have been a terrible governor. I don't know who got elected governor, but it was a good thing. That may have been
Tom Judge, I think.
Was the judge beat him, or was it?
Well, he lost the primary.
Yeah.
I think Ed Smith beat him in the primary.
I think that's right.
In that 1972.
Yeah. Ed Smith was a good guy.
Now, Tim Babcock and Jim Lucas were friends, I think.
Yeah,
they?
Yeah.
And they both kind of got clipped with the sales tax. Do you remember anything about how they got involved with that sales tax issue and how it came to be? Republicans generally oppose taxes.
Well,
why were they?
I'll tell you. Back in the early 60s. I'd have to think very carefully about just when it occurred. We kind of got everybody in the associations, in the trade associations, to get together. And we had kind of a truth squad tour around the state. And we put on a dog and pony show about taxes. And The same problems then are the same problems we got now. People were being hurt with increasing property taxes, and that every time something would slide, it would get sloughed over on property taxes. And the feeling generally among the associations, and we managed to sell it to everybody, was sales tax would be a good thing.
Okay.
And we went around the state promoting it, as a matter of fact, which wasn't popular.
And you did that when you were with the oil industry?
Yeah. Yeah. And
can you remember who some of the other players were?
Oh, sure. Basil, Andrew Copeland. One of the real ringleaders was the fellow that ran the Montana Taxpayers Association at that time, Keith
Anderson.
We had the Montana Liquor Dealers Association, or Bar, it may have been the Montana Liquor Dealers Association. And a fellow by the name of Kurt Leeds from Billings was their man. We had a guy from the Automobile Association who was limited quite a bit by his constituency with the auto dealers. They weren't all, I don't think they were all in favor of all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, who else
was there a Montana Power Company guy or a Anaconda Company guy?
No, I think they did things through the Taxpayers Association. We had the railroads. I'm trying to think who the railroad association guy was then. I guess it was Willard.
Yeah.
I'm not sure of that. I don't remember him being with us on the tour.
I'm going to interview him on Saturday, I think.
Yeah. I didn't realize that John was still alive.
Yeah.
When I worked for the Railroad Commission over here, I spent a lot of time with John. He was then with the Independent Record.
Yeah.
And I went hunting with him quite a bit. And John and I were good friends.
Well, that's good.
Is his wife still alive?
I don't think so. He had a stroke last November, and I talked to his son on the telephone, and he said his dad was still sharp in the mind, but he was laid up with some paralysis as a result of the stroke. He'll be 90 on his next birthday, and they've got him in some kind of a assisted living facility.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to meet him there on Saturday.
Okay. Well, she will. She will. She was very active in Helena, the kind of the early beginnings of the ladies' associations in Helena, especially relating to historical things. But she really was a nice guest. I thought a lot of her.
Well, I've heard good things about John Willard too, and
yeah.
I look forward to meeting him. But what you say is that some of the business organizations in the state decided that we could improve our tax system and make it more business friendly. So they kind of planted the seeds of tax reform, and that probably meant reducing property taxes with a sales tax.
With a sales tax.
And Tim bought into that.
Yeah, and a lot of people bought into
it. Yeah.
And I don't think, you know, I don't know that anybody in those days knew how politically explosive it was. You know, they didn't realize how politically explosive it was. But I don't know how anybody, even today, I don't know how anybody would sit down and look at our financial situation in Montana and think that it's perfectly reasonable for us to have a kind of a normal income tax, although the top end is a little heavy. But you've got a normal state income tax, no sales tax, and 67% or something of our public money is property tax.
Yeah.
Well, what a load you got on property tax.
Yeah.
And this, the reason was, in the old days, they got the Anaconda Company with it, they got the power company, they got the railroads. These were just, you know, it's the old saying, good taxes are somebody that's a tax that somebody else has to pay, not
sure.
You.
Yeah.
But I, you know, it really is silly.
Jim, we've got just 4 or 5 minutes left on our tape here. Is there anything, maybe with regard to the, you know, I guess I really haven't talked to you a lot about Tim Babcock, who you were probably closest to of any chief executive in the state, although you also probably knew Forrest Anderson, or anything that, anything more that you'd like to share with
me? I don't. The fellow who beat Tom Judge in the primary and became governor for 2 terms from Bull Point.
Ted Schwinden.
Ted Schwinden. I always had a high regard for Ted. He came to the legislature, and I'll tell you, he.
Well, yeah. In fact, he was a legislator when you were a lobbyist.
Yeah, and he. I mean to tell you, he was hard to lobby because he knew everything, and he didn't like oil companies, and he, goddamn, he. He'd beaten them out. He never sold didn't sell any of his minerals, and he didn't lease anybody ground for, you know, $1 an acre. And I kept pointing out to him, if he hadn't done so, he said they never drilled any wells around where he was. And I said, you'd have made $1 an acre off everything you had. You'd have been way money ahead. Now, it took him about 2 sessions. And he became knowledgeable then about the real world. I don't know that he'd ever been out of Wolf Point till he came down here. But I always had a high regard for Ted. I thought he was a sensible man and a good governor. Tim and I were, of course, I did a lot of some legal work for Tim before I worked for him, while I was practicing law. And I don't know anybody in the world a more likable person than Tim. I thought he made a lot of political mistakes, and I think Tim Tim got by on his personality to a great extent. I mean, he knew a lot of people and everybody liked him that he knew, and he could make a supporter out of anybody he could talk to. But he got off in areas that it just kind of drives you crazy.
How do you mean?
One time he had this big idea about when he, and this is when he was running against, what's his name, the Bitterroot.
When he was running for the Senate against Lee Metcalf?
Against Lee Metcalf. He made this thing kind of as his catchword or motto, return the farm back to the farmer. And I kept pointing out that this very poor English to start with. he talked about a lot of the grain programs, and he didn't really understand what that meant to the grain farmer. He got off on that, and that took him out of the race right there, just that one thing alone.
I think our tape's about shot.
Okay.
Any closing comment or anything?
No. I've enjoyed talking to you. A lot of marvelous people in
Montana. That's for sure. Well, thank you very much, Jim.
Well, you're welcome.
Thank you.